What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Summer Movies Podcast. My name is Eric Davis. I'm the managing editor over at Movies.com, and joining me, as he always does, is Sean O'Connell. He's the movies content director at CinemaBlend.com. Sean, we took a week off because of the July 4th holiday, and we're coming back to this podcast with a pretty tremendous movie arriving in theaters. Some say it's the best movie of the summer, and we're going to talk about whether or not it actually is. We're talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But first, Sean, how was your 4th of July?
It was chaotic. We had family visiting, and we were moving a family member, and so it was busy, busy.
There were fireworks. Were there fireworks in your house?
Well, we went to, not at our house, but see, in North Carolina, fireworks are legal, so you can. Well, wait, hold on. They're legal in South Carolina. They're illegal in North Carolina. You can buy them in one and shoot them off in the other, which is very strange to me. So,
so you could shoot fireworks off in North Carolina.
Right.
But you can't buy them in North Carolina.
Right. You have to buy them across the border.
Going to South Carolina.
South Carolina is only 5 minutes away. So it's very easy for people to load up, like, ammunition and then just fire it off into all hours. So it's pretty crazy down here. But I think what people need to be reminded from a movie perspective is that the 4th of July, it used to feel like the halfway point of summer, you know? And now, like, because the season's so front-loaded, it almost seems like I had a conversation with people that were like, summer's pretty much over in terms of blockbusters. And because they feel like they're exhausted from movies like Godzilla and X-Men and Spider-Man and Jump Street and Transformers, and that's a whole season condensed into a short amount of time. Like, there's still good stuff to come.
There is still good stuff to come. And yeah, it was weird. This 4th of July, a lot of people were asking me, is like, does the 4th of July for movies not exist anymore? Because, you know, you're used to big movies coming out on the 4th of July holiday weekend. This year, Transformers Age of Extinction is really the biggest movie, but they backed that up to the end of June. They did that with the last one, too.
Right.
So this 4th of July weekend was sort of lackluster. We didn't get any big movies. Deliver Us from Evil, Tammy, Earth to Echo, nothing sort of wow factor, which in some ways is actually good because it gave you a week off before Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is an excellent movie. And I'm curious to get to see what you thought. Now, we're recording this before it hits theaters, so I do want to be careful with spoilers on this episode. Usually we record after a movie comes out, and so we spoil the hell out of it. So let's talk about this film. We're not going to spoil it, but I do want to ask you whether or not you think it's the best movie of the summer.
That's interesting. I mean, the best. Are we talking blockbuster? See, right before we got on, we were talking about a movie called Boyhood, which you and I both love. We're talking like the best "quote unquote" summer movie, right?
Yeah, let's go. Let's go there. I mean, yeah. If you go nuts and bolts about it, if you say, yeah, the best movie that actually came out in the theater over the summer, you can include all kinds of other movies like Boyhood, which is also tremendous. I think if you take those two movies on coming out on the same weekend, this might be the best weekend for quality movies this summer.
I'm still leaning toward, and in terms of the way that I star rated them, I still liked X-Men Days of Future Past more than I liked Dawn. But I gave X-Men a 4.5 out of 5. I'd give Dawn a four out of five. So, I mean, we'd be nitpicking to go in between them. I loved them both, but I loved them for different reasons. But it's also because of where they fall in terms of their franchises.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like Dawn is taking a really interesting idea, a couple of ideas floated in Rise, and setting it up to tell a wealth of very interesting stories. Whereas, you know, Days of Future Past could only exist because it came after so many other interesting X-Men films, and it pulled off something that I didn't think was ever going to be possible on the big screen, and so I admired it for that reason.
Yeah, well, also, Days of Future Past is really wham-bam. It's big. There's a lot of big action set pieces in the film.
Yeah.
And a lot of characters, and some characters that we haven't seen in a long time. And so there's this sort of personal connection to X-Men Days of Future Past, I think, for a lot of people, because they've been with this franchise. You know, I mean, X-Men back in 2000 arguably kicked off this whole new superhero movie trend. So I could see exactly where you're coming from. For me, the best movie of the summer so far for me was Edge of Tomorrow. I loved that Tom Cruise movie. And then I first saw Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I'm like, you know what? I think this is my favorite movie of the summer so far. I think what it pulls off is pretty magnificent. You know, for a big summer movie, it's small and really intimate. And a lot of the themes in it sort of, you know, they don't sacrifice story at all in right. this film. And the themes of family and hope and of compassion really struck a chord with me. I was really emotional. This is the most emotional I was during, I guess you could say, a quote-unquote summer blockbuster, was watching this film. Maybe because, you know, because I have a family and we all have families and we're very close to our families. And this film is all about family.
And let's also point out the fact that it's emotional connections to characters that now they have actors underneath them, but they're largely digitally created, you know, CGI motion capture apes. And I was also, like you, dumbfounded at how connected I was to these characters, to Caesar and to Koba and to these, the way that the reason why I knocked it a star off of it is because as good as the human actors are in it, I do think that those personalities, those characters that Gary Oldman and that Jason Clarke have to play were a little bit too stock, like a little bit too, you've seen them in post-apocalyptic movies before. And the subplots that I really connected to were the ones that involved the apes. And that's unbelievable to me that, you know, I know technology is advancing and that we're able to do things on screen that we weren't able to do before. But the way that motion capture has improved just from Rise to Dawn is unbelievable, because I thought Andy Serkis gave an Oscar-worthy performance. And yet I'm disappointed knowing that the Academy probably won't even recognize the work that he's doing.
Yeah, no, it was pretty good. I think Coda, the actor who played Coda, right? Was that's the name?
Koba, sorry. Toby Kebbell.
Hey,
actor.
Almost more than Serkis. I feel like Caesar in this film is stuck between being a leader, being a father, and being the only ape that has this strong connection to humans. That sort of conflict within him, he kept it very internal, and so you saw it on his face, whereas Koba was all external, and everything that he felt you saw come out in everything that he did, whereas I think Caesar was keeping a lot of what he was feeling inside. So two very different performances that you can credit in various ways, but I think those two just were outstanding in this movie. And I do agree. A lot of people are saying that, yeah, I really love the apes. The humans weren't colored as much as I wanted them to be. But then again, this is Caesar's story. I mean, the film literally begins and ends on a close-up of his eyes.
Yes.
Saying, look, this is the story. We're showing you this story through his eyes. It's almost like saying, in an alien invasion movie, saying, you know what, that alien that was the bad, I really wanted to know more about his backstory. I really wanted to know what it was like when he grew up as a kid. And it's like, no, you don't. You don't. Because you're invested in the heroes. You're invested in who the movie is sort of telling the story through which character. And in this movie, that's Caesar and Koba and the apes. That's the story. I mean, the first 20 minutes of this movie is really beautiful. We spend all this time with the apes in the woods, and there's no dialogue really, which
well,
I think was
reason alone too. And I'm going to say it again to everybody. You know, we're talking spoilers. We're talking about if you want to not go into apes, you know, knowing a lot of things, but you know, maybe hit the pause button right now. Come back around, listen to us after you've seen it. But stop right now, and then I'll wait a minute, and then I'll.
Oh, you're dropping spoilers right
this
now.
This is it. There's a moment in the film where Koba shoots Caesar, and it's part of his longer his long con. You know, essentially, he's got a plan in place, and he's got a
his Nick Fury con. If we want to talk in summer movie subplots, this is his Nick Fury Captain America: The Winter Soldier long con.
Right, exactly. And I believed for a little while that they did it. I thought that they killed Caesar off. And at that point of the movie, they could have. And I think this is what Rise or Dawn had going for it, that the other movies like Captain America, the Winter Soldier, or something like that. When a major character like that dies, we automatically, or at least I do, I think, all right, well, they're not really dead because they need them long term.
No. Well, because so many movies are doing that. There's a Thor of the Dark World with Loki, Captain America, the Winter Soldier with Nick Fury. Sure. It's almost like a thing that's happening with every movie these days.
But the Apes franchise is set up in a way that there are so many rich storylines and characters and places that it could have gone, that when they teased that they were going to get rid of Caesar, I really thought, like, oh, you can at this point. You know, you could have. They could have pulled that off and stayed with it. And it's that bit of unknown. It's that mystery surrounding where this storyline can go that I think adds something even some more special that I appreciate about it. Because I don't, so many times with I don't want to keep hammering home the Marvel movies, but any of these films where it's the Spider-Man movie or even some of the X-Men movies, like, we feel like we're watching the story play out, but we already kind of know where it's going. And with Dawn, and I credit this to Matt Reeves, and I credit this to just the approach of the storyline, I don't really know where this franchise is going. And so it feels like going into each of these films and these sequels, and they're going to make more of them, more they like to, there's going to be this great air of mystery that I don't know the direction of it. And I think that's why I really like this story so much more. As it was unfolding, I was completely surprised and completely enveloped in the direction they were going. And I liked it so much more because of that.
Yeah, because you could really do anything. And your human counterparts don't need to necessarily come back in sequels. You're not hanging on. I mean, Caesar really is the only character that you sort of want to keep seeing. You want to keep following his story. But like you said, they could have killed off Caesar, and I think that it wouldn't have made a huge impact on the franchise. If anything, it would have been one of the most daring decisions.
Sure, right.
Now, but yeah, I agree.
It doesn't happen, and Caesar comes back, which I think is okay. But yeah, like you said, like, we don't see James Franco in this movie outside of a cameo of some footage that they had left over from Rise.
And you don't need to see him.
Right, it doesn't miss a beat. And they could do another movie a couple of years from now, and it could be 10 years even later into the ape, you know, possession of our planet, and we won't see Jason Clarke or Gary Oldman again. So there are so many possibilities as to where this movie can go.
That's fun, though. Isn't that a fun concept that you can keep swapping out the human casts of a franchise movie because it's the apes that is your one constant. That's who you keep coming back to. That's why you're showing up to the movie. And there's no other franchise like that. You know, I mean, outside of animated movies where it's the voices. But there's no other franchise like that.
How do you think this movie will do? Do you think people will be behind it? Do you think Rise was a big enough hit that this movie could do really well? Because you mentioned Edge of Tomorrow, and that's a really good analogy of a good movie that people out loud, people who do this for a living like you and I, told people out loud, it's a good movie, go see it, please, and nobody did. So is Apes destined for that, or does Rise help it?
I think Rise definitely helps it, and Rise of the Planet of the Apes did really well. I think there's a lot of people that are hankering to see this movie, so I think it has a real shot to do well. Right. I don't know how well. I don't know if we're talking X-Men Days of Future Past money.
Right.
Or even Maleficent money.
Yeah,
but
did really well, yeah.
Or Captain America the Winter Soldier money, but I think it'll do well. And I wouldn't be so. And I think it's going to wind up in the top 10 of the year.
Okay.
It definitely deserves to be. I think it's a tremendous movie, and you should go see it. But let's segue, because we'll just keep spoiling the movie for people and ruining it. You know, I think this movie is the best movie of the summer. Sean thinks it's running up to number two for the best movie of the summer. So I thought, let's go back to the last 5 years and pick out the best movies of those summers, now that we have some space and we can look back at them, you know, after maybe watching these movies a couple of times on Blu-ray, what have you. Let's go back and name our picks for the best movies of the summer. Sean, let's start. 2013.
Yes, sir.
Last year, I went with a sort of unusual pick.
Okay.
I went with World War Z.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, it ended up being more entertaining than people gave it credit for going into it, so...
Much more entertaining than I thought. I mean, going into World War Z, we just heard that this production was a mess. They had to reshoot the entire ending. They brought in Damon Lindelof. They brought in Christopher McQuarrie was involved, I think, at some point. and it was just all over the place. And then what they ended up with was pretty great, you know? And I think, if anything, it's that ending that they had to reshoot that saves the entire movie, because there's this giant movie for half the movie, and then all of a sudden, it becomes this tiny, small horror movie in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And they just switches gears like that, and it was so welcoming. I was watching this, and I just watched it again on Netflix recently, and it just... I'm not used to sort of that misdirection in a summer movie, and it was really welcoming, and I enjoyed it immensely. And that was my pick for the best movie of 2013. Keep in mind, we're going with quote unquote summer movies. They don't all have to be giant blockbusters, but they are summer movies.
Yeah, mine was a borderline summer movie. I'm going with The Great Gatsby, which is Baz Luhrmann's film, which I liked a lot more than I thought I was going to.
But it
came out in the summer, you know, summertime. It was that second weekend. It was coming after, what was it, Iron Man 3? Yeah, so people didn't expect it to do very well. It ended up posting like a $50 million opening, which I think speaks to DiCaprio, obviously. Probably speaks to Baz Luhrmann. He's got a following, too. And I checked it out again at the end of the year, and I liked it enough that it made like my second tier top 10 for movies of the overall movies at the end of the year. I just really thought they did an entertaining job of breathing a lot of life into that story. It had a really good sort of scene stealing part from Carey Mulligan, and I thought her chemistry with DiCaprio was great. So I'm going with Gatsby, and you can yell at me if you don't think it's a summer movie or not, but hey, it came out in May.
No, I agree. I loved it too. A little long. Tobey Maguire was a little boring, but other than that, I really liked it. 2012, I'm going with The Avengers.
All right, go ahead.
I got to go with Marvel's The Avengers. This film, like X-Men Days of Future Past, this is a film that we knew was coming, and we didn't know how they were going to team up Thor and Captain America and Iron Man and Hawkeye and Black Widow, and the Hulk sort of made his return, Mark Ruffalo playing him, and just kind of blew me away. This film really was one of the only films in recent years where clapping, standing up, cheering, the whole audience, my whole audience, when I saw this at a preview screening, literally stood up at the end and gave this movie a standing ovation. And I only see that at film festivals. I don't see that at preview screenings of superhero movies. So it was a really special movie, I think. And I can't wait to see what they do with Age of Ultron. I think it looks good.
All right, I want to detour just to ask you really quickly, do you think Age of Ultron can live up to that?
I think Age of Ultron can live up to it, and I think it will.
Oh, all right, good. Let's leave it at that.
Without going into further details, I think it will.
If you've listened to any of our podcasts, you understand that I'm a fan of Mark Webb and his Spider-Man films, and so I'm picking The Amazing Spider-Man for 2012.
Wow, people are not going to agree with you on that one.
Of course they won't, but that's what I'm here for. one of the only summer movies... I mean, we see these movies at press screenings, and quite often in the next week we're on to whatever the next big blockbuster is, and so I rarely go back and revisit films while they're in the theaters because I do want to see them on the big screen. And I saw Amazing Spider-Man... 3 times, I think, over the course of the summer. I brought my kids back one time. I went back with some friends another time. I just really loved what Webb is doing. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Amazing Spider-Man 2 also, and I'm curious to see what direction the franchise continues in with Amazing Spider-Man 3, if my boy Mark Webb is still with it, if they even make it. Who knows? The future is uncertain. But in 2012, I liked The Amazing Spider-Man.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I remember me and you talking, gushed on that film.
Yeah,
our podcast. We podcasted that film, I believe.
Franchise hit a wall. We've been doing this a while.
We have been doing this for a while. 2011, my pick, staying in the Marvel Universe, Captain America, The First Avenger.
A great movie.
This, I think, it might still be, it teeters between this and The Avengers in terms of my favorite Marvel movie, but I've been watching Captain America, The First Avenger a lot lately. It's been in a rotation, I think, on cable. And also, I believe it was on Netflix, whatever. I've been watching. I've watched it about 3 times in the last couple of months. And it's just one of those movies that has this incredible rewatchability factor. Not all the Marvel movies have this. And it feels vintage. Joe Johnston really brings this Indiana Jones vibe to it. More so, this feels more like an Indiana Jones movie than I think Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull feels like an Indiana Jones movie. And especially those early scenes in Brooklyn before Cap goes overseas are tremendous and really great. And it's funny, I was just talking to someone. We want to do a feature on some really great foot chases in movies. And there's an amazing foot chase. It's the first scene where Evans turns into Captain America and he first sort of learns how to become. That's what I really like about it, too, is those escalating scenes. It's like they start really small with just, okay, Cap is not even in a suit and he's just running and chasing a guy on foot through the streets. He's barefoot. And then they escalate to, like, where we see him in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, throwing shields, flipping, jumping, bouncing, throwing, just, he's all over the place. And it just shows you how small they started off. And it seems like that is why I really love this movie. It's just this just barefoot run through the streets of Brooklyn, and it was really cool. And so, yeah, First Avenger, that's my pick for 2011.
That list better have Point Break on it, so... The foot chase from Point Break where...
I have a bunch of foot chases. There's some really awesome foot chases in movies. Also, The Ghost Protocol through the dust storm.
Oh, that's a great one, too.
Great foot chase.
All right, I'm going 2011. I'm going with Fast Five. Fast Five being a movie that, against all odds, convinced me that a franchise I'd completely given up on can come back from the dead and become interesting yet again. Because didn't care for Too Fast, Too Furious, didn't care for Tokyo Drift... didn't care for whatever they called the fourth one. I think it's just called Fast and Furious. And then they add The Rock and shoot it down to Brazil, and it just all of a sudden everything was fresh and new and exciting. And you know, Fast Six seemed to expand on the premise and became goofy again. Still exciting, but kind of goofy. But Fast Five was just lean and angry and quick and energetic, and I just loved it. I loved it as a standalone film. I loved it as a continuation of the soap opera that is the Fast and Furious movies. I don't know if they're going to be able to do better than that, because now they're going back to adding, like, everyone under the sun. This new one has Kurt Russell and Jason Statham, and it's like, all right, now you're an Expendables movie. But in Fast Five, they got the formula right, and I thought it was one of the most memorable films that year, let alone in the summertime.
Definitely. I do not disagree.
Yep, cool.
Thank you. 2010, I'm going with Toy Story 3. Just I was a blubbering mess after I saw that film. It amazed me that Pixar was able to make a third installment of a movie that was that affecting, that emotionally sort of, you were that invested in. And was funny and entertaining and felt fresh in a lot of ways, but also familiar, and just leaves you crying and crying, weeping adults, but also, you know, incredibly engaging for kids. You know, just a special movie that I think hits, no matter what age you are, it hits a spot in you that makes it memorable, and I loved it.
All right, I'm going with Inception. Which came out in 2010 in July. And I was kind of shocked about that. For whatever reason, Inception feels like a November or December movie to me. Maybe because Nolan's got Interstellar coming out and that's going to be a November movie. But, I love when Nolan thinks outside of the Batman movies, as entertaining as those films are. I think he does much better with films like The Prestige and Memento and Insomnia. And then Inception was this total just puzzle, you know, being snapped into different places. And it was Nolan sort of showing, like, hey, I've learned how to do all these great blockbuster techniques, but I'm still this intricate storyteller at heart. Really good performances by people like DiCaprio, obviously, Tom Hardy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and just this great film that nobody could really figure out until the very last scene, and even that last scene being so debatable. I think that makes it such a memorable pick for 2010.
It is, and I'm really curious to see what he does with Interstellar. You know, Edgar Wright tweeted the other day that he's heard from people that Interstellar is Christopher Nolan's best film to date.
Okay.
I don't know how much stock you put in that, but I'm curious to see if it's as brainy as Inception. Is it as much of a thinker as Inception, right? Or is it more of a sort of spectacle? I'm just really curious to see how he balances the spectacle with the brainy stuff in this one.
Like, it seems like he could be on the verge of really taking off to become this, you know, huge filmmaker. Not that he isn't already, you know, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, well, and, you know, you hope that, you know, you look at these giant, big, visionary filmmakers these days.
Right.
And I'm kind of upset that we lost James Cameron to three more Avatar movies. You know, I want to see them. Avatar, you know, still to this day, Avatar is the best movie that I've seen in 3D.
Right.
And I think James Cameron is going to really push 3D and really give us a movie-going experience. But I'm sort of upset that we've lost him now for X amount of years to Avatar, because these are guys that nobody's pushing the boundaries of filmmaking like these guys, and to lose them to an entire franchise is something that you don't always want to see, but I'm going to see them. All right, lastly, we back up to 2009, and this is where I'm going to cash in my... it's a summer movie. Came out in August. You know, this is where I'm going to cash in that card. My pick is 500 Days of Summer.
Ah, so
I really like this one. Saw it at Sundance when it premiered. I fell in love with it there. Watched it countless times since then. Joseph Gordon-Levitt's little dance through the streets to Hall & Oates is one of my favorite musical moments of recent years. I love it when he looks in the rearview mirror of the car and sees Han Solo. But yeah, you know, this movie it says a lot about relationships and sort of people who, you know, you fall in love with that may not feel the same way for you, and the different sort of ways that relationships torture us and also make us whole. And I think, you know, circling back, hey, Mark Webb, there's your boy. This is his debut feature, and it's probably what got him Amazing Spider-Man. He brought a lot of those sort of the chemistry that he's able to get out of his actors. He brought that over to that Amazing Spider-Man, and so it's an incredible chemistry between Garfield and Emma Stone, who are a real couple in real life too. So, yeah, that's my pick for 2009. Loved it.
All right, I'm going with that's a great pick, by the way. I'm going with a big franchise movie, a sequel, to end this summer conversation on something that is very, very summer. And in 2009, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince came out. It was the last of the standalone Potters before we got into the two Deathly Hallows, and was, to me, the best, sort of leanest adaptation of the later Rowling books. Listen, you might not know this about me. I don't know if we ever discussed this, but I'm a huge fan of the Potter cinematic franchise. I think that it is the most impressive and accomplished adaptation series, franchise, like standalone franchise series that we've ever had. Like, more than Lord of the Rings, more than, I don't even know what would compare to it, because the fact that they were able to cast those kids and keep them together to complete all seven books or all eight movies is unbelievable to me. And some, I think Azkaban's probably the best of all of them, but Half-Blood Prince set up so many great storytelling moments that had to pay off in Deathly Hallows. And by breaking Deathly Hallows into two films, I always thought it sort of lost a little bit of its momentum. But Half-Blood Prince was just a roller coaster ride. And, you know, by the time they reached that film, the actors knew what they were doing, the cast and crew knew what they were doing, and it was a great summer movie. It was a great Harry Potter movie. And I still am amazed that they pulled off what they did with that franchise and with the same actors. It's similar to Boyhood, which we've come back around, where, mm-hmm. like, how does Linklater do that over the course of 12 years? Well, the same thing with the Potter franchise. How do they cast those kids and keep them together for the bulk of that adaptation and tell one overreaching story that went for eight films? It's amazing to me. And so I'm recognizing the beauty of that franchise by pulling out Half-Blood Prince in 2009.
Good selection. Were you able to go to Diagon Alley?
No.
Seems like that would be your...
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to
Mecca.
Go any of those set visits. I don't want to go to Orlando because it's 5 hours to ride on a ride. And, you know, it's I got into the Potter game a little bit too late. But I got to do the red carpet for the Deathly Hallows Part 2, and I got to speak to some of the cast, including Rickman, and that was kind of a moment. So
Very cool. So yeah, those are our picks. Last 5 years, best movie. When this summer is over, will it be Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? Will it be X-Men Days of Future Past? When we revisit this topic maybe next summer, will we still feel the same? We still have Guardians of the Galaxy coming up. I think if any film has a shot let's just end on this. If any film has a shot coming out this summer,
yes,
after Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, to become the best movie of the summer, I would say it's Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
What would you say?
I think it's that too, because I'm not super enthused about Hercules, and I'm hearing good things about Lucy, but you know, I don't know yet until I see it. So yeah, I'm going to put my faith in Guardians because I think that it's going to be that sort of out of left field, oddball movie that works in ways that we didn't even expect.
Yeah, so we'll see. As of right now, though, I say it's Dawn. Sean says it's Days of Future Past. What do you think it is? Feel free to comment. Or catch us on Twitter at Eric Davis, E-R-I-K-D-A-V-I-S, at Sean _O'Connell.
Thank you. Yes.
On Twitter. And you can find us also on our sites. I'm ImaginingEditorMovies.com. Sean over at CinemaBlend.com. Read us, love us, enjoy us, and enjoy your week at the movies. Go see Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Go see Boyhood. Two tremendous movies. Trust us. Have a good one.